Hello, and welcome to this educational session entitled Harnessing the Power of the Complement Pathway, Evolving Treatments and Improving Outcomes in PNH. I'm Carlos DeCastro. I'm a professor of medicine at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina.
Hi, my name is Pamika Patel. I'm an associate professor at Prisma Health Cancer Institute in Greenville, South Carolina. We look forward to teaching you guys about PNH in this educational session.
The learning objectives for this session are outlined here, and you can read through them.
So we'll be talking about translating biology into clinical practice, the complement pathway, and the current standard of care in PNH. PNH is an acquired hemolytic anemia that arises from a somatic mutation in the PIGA gene in the hematopoietic stem cell, which causes defective synthesis of the GPI anchor proteins, leading to the development of PNH and its associated clinical manifestations. It's characterized by chronic intravascular hemolysis due to the action of the complement on the abnormal red blood cells that are lacking the CD55 and CD59 regulatory proteins, in which PNH red blood cells lyse more readily in the presence of complement activation. PNH can be classified in three categories. We call it classical PNH, where there's only PNH that you're worried about, where there's chronic intravascular hemolysis. Then you have small PNH clones that can be in the presence of bone marrow failure syndrome, such as aplastic anemia, and you can see them in some circumstances in myelodysplastic syndrome. And subclinical PNH, where there's PNH clones detected in the setting where they're not clinically active, but something that we do monitor in clinical practice or may evaluate for. We can't talk about PNH without talking about the rarity of it. Its incidence is 1 to 1.5 cases in a million people, likely underestimated due to underdiagnosis and delay to diagnosis. It may be slightly more common in females and may occur more frequently in Asia versus the United States and Europe. PNH may be diagnosed at any age, but usually the median age of diagnosis for PNH is around the age of 30. Another important basic foundation of understanding PNH is the complement system. The complement system is composed of greater than 40 proteins in the blood or on the surface of cells. It's the immune surveillance systems for humans. And so for what's important to take away from the complement system, it's our first line of defense against various organisms, various microorganisms, and is involved in our immunological and inflammatory responses. And so each part of our complement system plays an important role, proximal and the terminal does. And that's important to keep in mind in fighting off certain organisms, such as our encapsulated organisms. Many different events can activate our complement system, including trauma, infection, and stress. And PNH is a dysregulation of the complement system because of the lack of CD55 and 59, which leads to red blood cells to lyse more actively and causes the complement system to be more activated. Consequences of the complement system and PNH include chronic intravascular hemolysis, in which we see anemia, where you will find clinical serological markers of positive for elevated LDH, D-dimers, low haptoglobulin, and you'll find a negative direct Coombs test. This is when I would think about this in a clinical setting where you have an individual who has anemia and active hemolysis. And this is what type of clinical indicators you may see when you're suspecting PNH. And you may see an elevated or decreased reticulocyte count, especially if there's a concern for underlying bone marrow failure. Intravascular hemolysis and PNH can lead to iron deficiency anemia and uncontrolled complement activation in intravascular hemolysis. In patients with untreated PNH can lead to end organ damage, such as chronic kidney disease, pulmonary hypertension, and as we know, one of the most feared complications of PNH is thrombosis. Other clinical markers that may, you're worried about in PNH are you may see some mild leukopenia and thrombocytopenia. Individuals diagnosed with PNH may have also poor quality of life because of the chronic intravascular hemolysis leading to anemia. Symptoms at presentation are not unique to PNH, which is why it's important to keep PNH in your differential when you're suspected, when you have cytopenias of unclear etiology or hemolysis of unclear etiology, which is Coombs negative. Think about PNH. So individual symptoms may be hemolytic anemia, often requiring transfusions, fatigue, dyspnea, abdominal pain, or dysphagia. Because of the lack of specificity of symptoms with PNH, a lot of patients, there's a delay to diagnosis, which is why sometimes keeping it in your differential will help you in diagnosing these patients more readily and making sure you're promptly diagnosing them and also making sure they're promptly treated in the appropriate fashion if clinically indicated. Untreated PNH can lead to early mortality and morbidity, which is one of the most feared complications. This is the risk of thrombosis, along with end organ damage and other symptomology, as we've discussed. So keep it in your differential, because it'll help in assessing, you know, when you're thinking about PNH, these are some of the symptoms and clinical parameters you may find. But also, the thing is, think about it in your differential when you're clinically assessing patients. One of the most, one common, you know, theme I use, like, you know, the catchphrase has been great to use, utilizing clinical practice for me, especially, and I think a lot of other clinicians across the United States, is when in doubt, I test for PNH. When there's cytopenias of unexplained etiology, there's aplastic anemia for sure that we teach for acquired aplastic anemia, we test for PNH at diagnosis and we monitor them routinely. In certain subtypes of MDS, we test for PNH. Thrombosis that's unexplained, we test for PNH. And then Coombs negative hemolytic anemia, as we discussed, and hemoglobinuria. These are common clinical indicators that where I think about PNH, and where PNH is a test that can be run easily off the peripheral blood with high sensitivity flow cytometry. So keeping it in your differential really is helpful in these set scenarios. And I think it keeps it, make sure that you can test for it easily too. You don't require bone marrow biopsy at the beginning, unless if otherwise clinically indicated in the setting of bone marrow failure. But I think this is an easy test that can be utilized by clinicians in all practices when in doubt in any of these clinical instances. So as we alluded to, using the catchphrase, you test for high sensitivity flow cytometry. So high sensitivity flow cytometry flare on the peripheral blood is the gold standard for testing for PNH. It has the increased sensitivity to detect it small abnormal populations, because monocytes and granulocytes have shorter half-lives, and numbers are not affected by transfusions. And analysis of GPI anchor proteins on the neutrophils or monocytes is preferred. FLAIR assay binds selectively with high affinity GPI anchor of most cell lineages, and most useful to the GPI anchor on granulocytes. So certain reports of when you get these reports back from flow cytometry will tell you there's either no PNH clone, which is type 1, type 2, where there's partial deficiency of a type 2 PNH clone. So you may have only some of your cells that are losing CD55, 59, and then type 3 is where there's complete loss of CD55 and 59 deficiency in that setting, because you don't have those GPI anchor proteins. So keep in mind, type 2 and type 3 can be clinically relevant. That's when you need to be, you know, looking at other clinical parameters also, because the larger the clone, the increased risk of thrombosis, which has been seen in multiple studies. So it's important to know how to assess the clone, how to make sure and in its appropriate clinical context, but also making sure you're addressing that and treating it promptly in the appropriate setting. So the current standard of care for PNH, so once the diagnosis is made, so we know the first FDA-approved therapy for PNH was eculizumab, subsequently followed by ravulizumab, which is our C5 inhibitors. Subsequently, we had the C3 inhibitor approved, pegcetacoplan. And most recently, we had the factor B iptacopan approved, which is an oral factor B inhibitor. These treatments have literally changed the treatment paradigm for PNH from eculizumab to where we are today. And these have decreased mortality and morbidity and helped change clinical practice for our patients where there was not, like, outside of supportive care, there was not many treatment options prior to eculizumab for our patients with PNH. Each of these treatment modalities have their different mechanism of action. As we know, C5 inhibitors are terminal complement inhibitors, C3 inhibitors are proximal complement inhibitors, and the oral factor B is also a proximal inhibitor. And in conjunction with complement inhibition, when we're treating our patients with for PNH, we are thinking about supportive care. There's individuals that may still require, transfusions despite optimal therapy. So you may have to treat iron overload if progressive. There's the role of anticoagulation is also very unclear, because of the fact that, you know, there's some of these patients where they present and they may have a clot. And so how long do you, in optimal setting for PNH, how long do you continue anticoagulation for these patients? Usually in the upfront setting, I do anticoagulate patients to make sure they're stabilized, depending on, you know, how their clinical scenario. If they're unstable, anticoagulation is preferred while you're getting treated these patients with their complement inhibition therapy. You may consider using erythropoietin stimulating agents because of the fact that they may have a lack of erythropoietin stimulating the bone marrow to produce red blood cells. So that will help in producing red blood cells, especially in the setting of chronic kidney disease. You may think about that. You may have to treat iron deficiency anemia with the setting of iron deficiency. And in the setting of aplastic anemia for PNH, you may think about immunosuppressive therapy. So there's a small cohort, I would say about like 20% or 10 to 20% or less, you see patients with AAPNH. And these patients, you may have to treat the PNH along with aplastic anemia. So you may think about immunosuppressive therapy with that, such as a cyclosporin, ATG, if in the appropriate clinical scenario. Allogeneic transplant is very rarely utilized in patients with classical PNH, but you may consider in patients with AAPNH, depending on how their responses to therapy and their clinical scenario, their age, and other clinical parameters that you may consider for these patients. And our treatment goals for patients with PNH is to improve anemia, reduce fatigue, improve the quality of life, but reduce the risk of thrombosis and end organ damage. So, you know, you can't talk about PNH without talking about the first FDA-approved therapy for PNH, which was eculizumab, which is anti-C5 antibody. Eculizumab was the first-in-class humanized anti-C5 monoclonal antibody, which is very high affinity binding for human C5. And each eculizumab C5 molecule binds to two C5 proteins, and it was the first therapy that was specifically targeted to complement-mediated hemolysis. Eculizumab is unique among the humanized monoclonal antibodies because germline human framework accelerator resequences were used to minimize the immunogenicity. And the human IgG2 and 4 heavy chains constant regions were used to eliminate the ability of the antibody to bind to the Fc receptors and activate the complement. And first time this eculizumab was evaluated was in a pilot study, which was a phase 2 study, open label study that included about 11 patients and was 12 weeks long. Subsequently, this was followed by the Triumph study, which was a phase 3 double-blind placebo-controlled randomized multi-centered study. To be eligible, patients had to have a history of 4 or more transfusions a year, a platelet count of greater than 100,000, and platelets patients received either Soliris or placebo for 26 weeks. The subsequent other study was a Shepherd study, which was a phase 3 open label multicenter study in a broader, more diverse patient population. And in this study, it included patients with lower transfusion requirements, including patients with thrombocytopenia, where the platelet cutoff was greater than 30,000. And patients were treated with Soliris for 12 months. The Triumph and Shepherd study were designed to establish the safety and efficacy of eculizumab in patients with PNH, and combined were the basis for Soliris approval and support the prescribing information for eculizumab for patients with PNH. All patients in the pilot, Triumph, and Shepherd trials were eligible to enroll in the extensions trials, including placebo-treated patients and Triumph, who are now receiving Soliris. So what eculizumab showed, and just to give a summary, is significantly reduced the hemolysis and the underlying cause of morbidity and mortality in PNH. There was 86% reduction in hemolysis, as we can see when you compare the placebo to eculizumab in the LDH marker, which is a marker of intravascular hemolysis. There was 92% reduction in thrombotic events, 73% reduction in the need for transfusions, and significant reduction in fatigue and improvement in quality of life measures. Adverse events were similar to placebo, but keep in mind, eculizumab does not treat the PNH-associated bone marrow failure and does not completely correct the defect that's at the stem cell, but it does help you control the intravascular hemolysis and its associated complications in individuals with PNH. Subsequently, as we were wanting to improve on the care for patients with PNH, we have ravulizumab, which was approved. And ravulizumab is another C5 terminal complement inhibitor, which binds to the complement component C5, inhibiting the terminal complement activation, decreases hemolysis of the red blood cells, that decreases the risk of thrombosis, but does not fix the defect at the hematopoiesis. Up to a third of patients treated with C5 inhibitor experience symptomatic anemia and transfusion dependency despite optimal therapy with eculizumab and ravulizumab. And it reduced both of these agents, eculizumab and ravulizumab, reduce intravascular hemolysis, but does not address extravascular hemolysis, which is, a component that we see commonly in patients treated with C5 inhibitors. And this is C3B mediated. What's important in prior to initiating therapy with C5 inhibitors is you want to vaccinate these patients 2 weeks prior to the treatment with your meningococcal encapsulated organism, which is your meningococcal vaccines, because there is a risk of 0.5 to 1% risk of meningitis in patients treated with complement inhibition, which stresses the importance of making sure patients are vaccinated prior to initiation of therapy. However, in urgent clinical scenarios, you can use prophylactic antimicrobial therapy to get therapy started in patients that are hemodynamically stable or need clinically urgently need to be treated for their PNH. Here are the black box warnings for both eculizumab and ravulizumab, which is stresses the important why it's important for clinical practitioners to make sure that they vaccinate their patients prior to initiation of therapy for PNH, and also making sure this 2 weeks prior and following the most recent ACIP guidelines, so that way you're not you're continuing to follow your patients that are being actively treated with complement C5 inhibitors. You're following through on their immunizations subsequently after they've been started on therapy, because we do want to mitigate that risk. Even though the risk is small, the risk is still there, and we want to make sure we protect our patients. Similarly, there's another black box warnings on with ravulizumab, as we've previously discussed. So we want to make sure that, you know, all clinical providers that are prescribing PNH drugs are enrolled in REMS programs. So the thing is, they go through extensive training to make sure that they're, qualified to prescribe it, and they know how to monitor patients for these. They educate their patients about the risk of meningitis, but also they're following through on their most recent immunization guidelines. In summary, there will be choices for therapies to discuss with your patients. And I think that's the most important, one of the important takeaways I want to say. This is an exciting time in PNH. We have terminal complement inhibitors, which have basically revolutionized our treatment outcomes for our patients with PNH, where supportive care was the only thing we had prior to their approval. And with terminal complement inhibitors, we've decreased the risk of morbidity and mortality and the risk of thrombosis. And now we have also proximal complement inhibitors, which are FDA approved. So when we talk about the terminal complement inhibitors, we have eculizumab, ravulizumab, which are C5 inhibitors, and we have the proximal inhibitors, pegcetacoplan, which is C3 inhibitor, and iptacopan, which is recently approved, which is an oral factor B inhibitor. So I think we're in an exciting time where we can personalize therapy for our patients. Based upon the data that Dr. DeCastro will be discussing, we're in an era where we have newer agents, where data is very exciting and safe for our patients to be initiated on therapies which meet their lifestyle, which is most appropriate clinically for them and available to them. Prior to initiation of all of these therapies, it's important to make sure you're following the immunization guidelines. And also, if you have an opportunity to enroll patients on clinical trials, it's great, because the thing is that that's how we learn more about these drugs and how we can improve the care for our patients with PNH. Keep in mind, newer drugs will make this disease more manageable, and it's going to be practice changing for them. And as we know, from where we started with one drug approval, we're up to four. And I think there's more new exciting therapies to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Patel. That was wonderful. I'm going to now cover the newer agents that are coming out in treatment of PNH, which has really changed the field and made things very exciting. So prior to the era of complement inhibition, treatment was primarily supportive in nature. For hemolytic episodes, we used to use transfusion support if needed. And while controversial, we did use steroids to shorten the hemolytic episodes, but chronic therapy with steroids obviously has long-term side effects. For patients who had bone marrow failure, if it was severe enough, we would try immunosuppressive therapy, much similar to what we do for aplastic anemia. And in those cases that failed that and still had severe cytopenias, we could consider bone marrow transplant. For patients who had thrombotic episodes, we would obviously put them on anticoagulants. The problem with that is these patients still tend to have future thrombotic episodes. And so this was prior to the era of complement inhibition, an indication for bone marrow transplantation, although this was always difficult. Blumick already covered that we have four drugs now approved, FDA approved for the treatment of PNH. And there are a bunch, as I've listed here, that are in clinical trials, some of which may get approval in the near future. Supportive care is always an important part of everything we do, including transfusion support. The role of using prophylactic anticoagulants is still very unclear. If you do have a thrombotic episode, though, we do recommend putting patients on anticoagulants. And allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplant has a very limited role in the age of these new complement inhibitors. So Bhumika covered the complement pathway, and there are multiple points that we can attack the complement pathway now. C5 was the initial point that was picked in part because it was felt that this would be the safest point to inhibit complement, as kids that are congenitally deficient in C5 only get meningococcal infections. Kids who are deficient in the proximal pathway are much more immunocompromised and get all sorts of infections, especially encapsulated organisms. We have some newer C5 inhibitors that are in clinical trials. These include drugs such as crovalimab, pozelimab plus cedisiran, which is a silencing RNA molecule, and zilucoplan. There's also an antibody called KP-104, which is dual function in that it has a factor H portion on the terminal portion of the antibody. And by linking these two, we get inhibition both of the proximal and terminal components of complement. I'll cover these just briefly, as a lot of data was presented at the recent ASH meeting. Crovalimab is a engineered antibody that was using this SMART technology. Using this, it is in the circulation and recirculates, so it has a much longer half-life, and you can give low doses or low volume subcutaneously at home. So the current recommendation for this drug is to give it subcutaneously every 4 weeks. It is a high affinity binding antibody. It has preferential uptake, antibody uptake, which is innovative, and it is an acid sensitive binding and antigen degradation. So once it is in the circulation, it recirculates through the system. 3 phase 3 studies have been done using this antibody, and they're shown here. 2 of them are in C5 inhibitor naive patients, and one of them is a randomized study comparing it to eculizumab in patients who have a suboptimal response. You see here the loading doses that were given in the studies, and the key findings were that this antibody is clearly non-inferior to eculizumab and controls hemolysis very well, and also leads to transfusion avoidance in these patients. It is also very effective in complement-naive patients. You see here from this presentation at ASH, the efficacy amongst the phase 3 studies are shown here. Hemolysis control was very comparable to eculizumab and ranged anywhere from 75% to 92%. There was a high incidence of transfusion avoidance in these patients. There was still an instance of breakthrough hemolysis in these patients, so any complement activating event can lead to a breakthrough hemolytic episode. A good number of these patients had what's called hemoglobin stabilization, that is, they didn't fall and didn't need transfusions, and fatigue scores improved markedly in patients on this antibody. So it will likely be taken up by the FDA in the near future for possible approval. One thing we did learn from using crovalimab is that these patients were already on a C5 inhibitor such as eculizumab, and by giving an antibody that binds to a different episode on C5, you can lead to this formation of multimers, also known as transient immune complexes, and these can lead to a transient immune complex reaction, as we call it. It is usually self-limited and goes away in around 2 weeks, and the primary clinical presentation of this was more rash than anything else. There did not appear to be any anaphylaxis or any sort of a kidney damage caused by these transient immune complexes. I will mention now pozelimab and cemdisiran. Pozelimab, again, is another anti-C5 monoclonal antibody with a different epitope. And cemdisiran is this small interfering RNA that suppresses liver production of C5. And the hope is by having less production of C5 along with the antibody there is that you will have less episodes of breakthrough hemolysis. This combination is now in phase 2 and phase 3 trials, and I show you here just the presentation of the phase 2 data at the ASH meeting in December, where patients received this drug. Now, you'll note this is a small study. The N is only 5, and despite our hope of seeing less breakthrough hemolysis, they've already had one episode during a complement activating event. So we will have to see if this combination of drugs really does work better in terms of preventing breakthrough hemolysis. I will just briefly mention zilucoplan. Zilucoplan is a cyclic peptide that binds C5 and inhibits its cleavage. It is given subcutaneously once a day. It is now FDA approved for the treatment of myasthenia gravis. There were some early trials in PNH which looked promising, but I think the company has decided not to take this further in terms of PNH. Now, as was mentioned, there are some limits to C5 targeting therapy that we learned about as we did these studies and followed these patients more long-term. The big issue is that the responses are somewhat heterogeneous in that almost all the patients have coating of their red cells with C3 fragments, as was mentioned. And almost all, a lot of patients are now showing low levels of continued hemolysis. Some of these can be quite marked, and about 25 to 35% of patients may still require red cell transfusions. So we call these patients suboptimal responders. Anybody who is still markedly anemic and fatigued, or anybody who still needs transfusion, is a suboptimal responder to a C5 therapy. And we think that the majority of these cases are caused, again, by this extravascular hemolysis. So as these C3 fragments are on the surface of the PNH red cells, they are taken up by the reticuloendothelial system, and this leads to extravascular hemolysis. And the degrees of this are different in different patients. So this led to a look at proximal complement inhibition. Again, the proximal complement inhibitors are there to block C3 and earlier parts of the complement cascade, as shown in this cartoon. And by doing that, we hope that we will not see this extravascular hemolysis from the C3 coating on PNH red cells. Now, we've targeted initially C3, factor B, and factor D. The first of these was the C3 inhibitor called pegcetacoplan, which is a pegylated pentadecapeptide. It is given subcutaneously by a pump twice a week. There is now an on-body injector that was approved that makes it a little easier for patients in that they just pop this right onto their skin and it gives it automatically. The Pegasus trial was the phase 3 randomized multicenter trial that was the registry trial, and it compared pegcetacoplan to eculizumab in PNH patients that had a hemoglobin less than 10.5, that is probably suboptimal responders. The primary endpoint was the change in hemoglobin at week 16, and you see in this bar graph on the right here that we gave the patients both drugs for 4 weeks so there wouldn't be any hemolytic episodes during the time that we were transitioning patients from one drug to the other. And then they were randomized to either pegcetacoplan alone or eculizumab alone. And pegcetacoplan was clearly superior in raising the hemoglobin levels by week 16. Other outcomes that were looked at were all non-inferior outcomes. And again, pegcetacoplan looked better in almost all of these in terms of the clinical outcomes. The side effects from pegcetacoplan are fairly mild and tolerable. These include injection reactions at the site of injection, since it is a sub-Q drug, diarrhea, which was usually mild and self-limited, and there were some cases of breakthrough hemolysis. Now, the concern is, as we treated patients with these C3 inhibitors, we blocked both intravascular and extravascular hemolysis, and by doing so, there was a larger proportion of PNH red cells in the circulation. And if a complement-activating event came along that increased the levels of C3, you could overwhelm this drug. And the real concern, which has really never been proven, is that these episodes of hemolysis would be more brisk and more severe. The PRINCE trial looked at pegcetacoplan in complement inhibitor-naive patients. This was done outside of the U.S. And again, you see the same rise in hemoglobin as compared to standard of care in patients with PNH. So the FDA approved this drug for both naive patients and for patients if they wanted to switch from a C5 inhibitor. I'll change gears now to factor B and factor D as targets. Factor B and factor D are cofactors for the C3 convertase and are necessary for C3 activation and then leading to further activation of the complement system. So if you inhibit either factor B or factor D, you can get blockage again of that amplification loop and of C3 convertase. Iptacopan is the first in class oral. It is given orally, as the others have all been IV or sub-Q, and it is a factor B inhibitor. There were two trials that looked at this, the APPLY trial and the APPOINT trial. APPLY is the open-label randomized multicenter phase 3 trial in patients with residual anemia, despite usually a C5 inhibitor. There were two primary endpoints, again, looking at the hematological response, as described as an increase from baseline to greater than 2 grams per deciliter without red cell transfusions, or as a response defined as a hemoglobin rising above 12 grams per deciliter in the absence of transfusions. And when we looked at this applied trial, oral iptacopan monotherapy had significant improvement in achieving a meaningful hemoglobin increase in these patients without any transfusions. And there was a reduction in fatigue compared to standard of care. And as Bhumika mentioned, this drug was just approved in December of 2023. It is oral, which is very attractive to patients. One of the concerns is what happens if the patient is non-compliant, as it does have a short half-life and has to be given twice a day. And that concern still exists. So we would not recommend this in a patient that you know will have issues with non-compliance. You see here the presentation from the ASH meeting, where the patients who were on the iptacopan arm and those that were on the eculizumab arm, who were allowed then to cross over and get iptacopan after 24 weeks. And all of them had this rise in hemoglobin to above 12, which was very impressive, or close to all of them had this rise in hemoglobin above 12. There were still some breakthrough events that occurred with iptacopan. So we still haven't found the perfect drug that's going to prevent breakthrough hemolysis if there is a complement activating event. We're still looking for that, and that may be future drugs, but we are still hoping that these drugs are clearly reducing this incidence of breakthrough hemolysis. The incidence of estimated incidence of breakthrough hemolysis with iptacopan is about 0.11. The APPOINT study was a phase 3 multicenter study done, again, outside of the U.S. In patients who were treatment naive. And again, you see that same rise in hemoglobin level in patients who have never seen a complement inhibitor. So this drug is very effective, whether you've been on a C5 inhibitor or you've not been on one. And at least in this multicenter study, there were no episodes of breakthrough hemolysis. So we'll talk briefly about danicopan. Danicopan is an oral factor D inhibitor. So again, one of the cofactors for activating C3. It is being tried in patients compared to eculizumab, but it's being given in combination with eculizumab or ravulizumab in PNH patients who have extravascular hemolysis ongoing. The primary endpoint of this study was a change in hemoglobin from baseline to week 12, and all key secondary endpoints were found to be improved, including a hemoglobin greater than 12, LDH, fast fatigue scores. So this drug, again, looks very promising, but again, it has to be given in combination with a C5 inhibitor, so that even though it's oral, patients will still need to get either IV or sub-Q C5 therapy. You see here again from the ASH presentation, this now following patients out for 48 weeks, that even on the long-term extension study, this response in terms of hemoglobin levels was maintained for 48 weeks on patients with danicopan and a C5 inhibitor. There were no deaths. There were no meningococcal infections. There were no discontinuations due to hemolysis. Again, there were, unfortunately, some breakthrough events even on these drugs, even though we're blocking both the proximal and terminal portions of complement. I'll briefly mention two drugs that are under investigation, although there are all probably others that are also under investigation. KP-104, as I mentioned, is this anti-C5 antibody, which they've engineered to link a portion of factor H, which is an inhibitor of the proximal pathway. And so this drug blocks both proximal and terminal complement pathways, and it will be a single drug given intravenously. And this was presented again at the ASH meeting. And you see here the hemoglobin levels when they got to the middle cohort showed hemoglobin levels above 14 by week 24. So maybe we're seeing even more improvement in terms of raising the hemoglobin to near normal levels. All the other key clinical endpoints looking at this drug from hemoglobin increases and red cell transfusion avoidance was 100%. So LDH levels fell in the vast majority of these patients to less than 1.5 than normal, and in some even to less than 1 times the normal level. 94% avoided breakthrough hemolysis. The other agent I'll just mention is this OMS 906 agent, again presented at the ASH meeting. This is a monoclonal antibody targeting the MAS3, which is part of the lectin binding protein activation, which we never thought it would have been involved in PNH. But it turns out that MAS3 is an activator converting pro-factor D into the active form of factor D. And by doing inhibiting MAS3, there is no increase in MAS3 as part of any sort of inflammatory pathway. And so you can get complete blockage of factor D by blocking at MAS3. And you see here in this early study that was done, again, hemoglobin levels rising above 14 to 16 in patients on this agent. So perhaps this will be a promising agent also. So we have complement inhibition for PNH, and now we have four FDA-approved agents. Which one should we use? And there are probably going to be more agents on the way. Some target the terminal pathway. Others are targeting the proximal pathway. Some are actually going to target both of the pathways. At least one of the FDA-approved drugs is oral. Others are given intravenously and sub-Q at various intervals. Some, as I just showed you, may be better at achieving a higher hemoglobin level. Brachyhemolysis is still an issue. As you get better and better, you have a higher percentage of circulating PNH cells that are susceptible to any complement activation. And we have to consider all the side effects and all the other problems listed here in terms of which patient should get which drug. There's going to be a patient preference issue. Patients may want to be on an oral drug. Others may say, no, I want the IV drug given every 8 weeks. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And there's going to be insurance issues in terms of cost and which ones the insurance companies prefer as time goes on. So we're still in an era of trying to figure out which ones are going to be best and which ones should be used. And it should probably be tailored to each individual patient with a discussion of the side effects and risks of each drug. At this point, I'd like to stop and just present a case study. This patient is a 41-year-old female who presented in January of 1998 with shortness of breath and heavy menstrual periods. She was found to be quite pancytopenic. A workup, including all sorts of studies with a bone marrow biopsy, showed aplastic anemia. And she was treated with ATG and cyclosporin, which was the standard at the time, and had complete count recovery. She even had a bone marrow biopsy a year later that was normal cellular. She did well for many, many years until 2013 when she noticed increasing fatigue. And when she went to her PCP, she had a hemoglobin of 5.7 with a platelet count and a white cell count that were just slightly low. She had a bone marrow biopsy done, which was normal cellular, and she had erythroid hyperplasia. She had a normal FISH and normal cytogenetics, and the physician there was smart enough to run a test for PNH, and her peripheral blood flow cytometry test was positive. She was started on eculizumab in 2013 because it was the only drug available at that time. In January of 2014, she had a white count of 3.8, a hemoglobin of 9.4, platelet count of 188, and an LDH that was lower, but not quite normal at 268. She was referred for a possible bone marrow transplant, but not felt to be a candidate. And then she continued to go on, not feeling very well and requiring transfusions on average about every 3 months, despite increasing the dose of eculizumab to 1,200 milligrams every 2 weeks. In 2017, she was referred to me. You see her hemoglobin was 7.6 with normal white cells and platelets. Her LDH still was in the slightly elevated range of 263. She had a high bilirubin, normal transaminases, a very high reticulocyte percentage. Her Coombs test was weakly positive for complement. So I'm going to ask Dr. Patel to comment on her labs and what she would like yet to see if this patient really is not responding well to her therapy.
Thank you, Dr. DeCastro. I think, you know, this is a great case that we commonly see in clinical practice. I think, number one, you stressed an important point, the importance of monitoring for a PNH clone, especially in aplastic anemia, and the evolution of it and how you you continue to monitor aplastics with a PNH clone and making sure they don't have evolution of it and making sure they're managed properly. Some of the things, some of the highlights here for me as a clinician that I would I'm a little bit worried about is this, despite optimal C5 therapy, she has ongoing anemia, right? And she's still requiring transfusions. So some of these were the, flags that, as you were discussing the case that stood out to me. Her white blood cells and platelets look good, but definitely she still has a degree of ongoing hemolysis, intravascular hemolysis, but her weekly positive DAT shows that she has some, just with optimal C5 therapy, she has extravascular hemolysis. So she would be a candidate that I would think about using a proximal inhibitor to try to get her some better improvement in her anemia, so that way she can have improvement in her symptoms in her transfusion requirements. And I think that's when I would think about C3 inhibitors or potentially consider oral factor B inhibitor, depending on her clinical situation. I would consider that.
Well, thank you, Emeka. Yes, that's exactly what we thought at the time. We thought she was a suboptimal responder due to C3 coating of her red cells and this extravascular hemolysis that was ongoing in her. So she was entered onto the Pegasus clinical trial using APL-2, which is now known as pegcetacoplan, in 2019. She did absolutely wonderful. She continues to be followed on pegcetacoplan. She has no complaints. You see her hemoglobin rose to 14.6. Her LDH is normal. She has a normal eosinophil count. And her PNH screen now shows that her red cell clone size is approximating her white cell clone size. That is, the PNH cells are 95 to 97%. She's been converted over to commercial products since 2020 and continues to do very well. So this is an example of using a C3 inhibitor in somebody who's had a suboptimal response to C5 inhibition due to extravascular hemolysis.
I would agree. She seems like she's doing really well. So I think this was a great, plan for her moving forward. And especially with the new infusion devices, this patient's going to do well as she moves forward.
So in conclusion, PNH is a very rare and unique disease. It's acquired. You're not born with this. It's characterized by hemolysis, cytopenias, and thrombotic episodes. Inhibition of the complement pathway has led to marked improvements in hemolysis, quality of life, and in data I haven't shown you, survival. And we now have multiple options for targeting the complement pathway at different points, which are either FDA approved or will become available hopefully in the near future. This concludes our discussion of the evolving products and treatments available for PNH patients. Please don't forget to log in and complete your evaluation for a continuing education credit. And thank you so much for your participation.